From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. And if you're like me, the last couple years, you've felt this rising sense of dread when watching the news. Mass shootings by white supremacists, violent rallies, opinion shows regurgitating white nationalist talking points, and of course, social media. The new frontier of extremism. It is everywhere. Reveal has been covering these movements, and for the next 2 weeks, we're taking a deep dive into hate, examining institutional racism, and also the hidden methods terrorists use to spread hate like a virus. This March, a gunman massacred dozens of Muslim worshipers in Christchurch, New Zealand. Megan Squire was in her car, headed back to her home in North Carolina, when she heard the news.
And I heard two different newscasters flipping back and forth between the news stations. And one of them said they saw an 83-page manifesto or something like that. And the other one said a 70-something page manifesto. And I went, ooh, what's going on here? There's multiple versions.
Megan is a computer scientist and professor at Elon University. A few years ago, she was researching, well, boring things like software developers. No offense. That work ended. Donald Trump was elected. And she started focusing her research on how extremism is spreading online.
I'm a computer scientist. What can I provide? What can I offer? What patterns can I find? How can I understand what's happening in our country, what's happening on the internet from a, you know, very systematic, data-driven kind of way?
Megan was driving and listening. Her thoughts were locked on the massacre and how the shooter was using the internet by live streaming the attacks and publishing his manifesto.
I'd already been collecting sort of these hate manifestos from different killers, trying to do some text mining on it and see what themes they were taking from one another, see if they were radicalizing one another. So when I heard there was a manifesto here and that there were multiple versions of it, that was extremely interesting to me. So I raced home, started, wrote some software to begin collecting as many different versions of the manifesto as I could find so that I could compare what was changing in between them.
And what'd you find?
So I collected a couple hundred different versions of the manifesto, found that they weren't changing it terribly much. Sometimes there was cover art added and things like that, but they weren't. They were treating the manifesto as an artifact, or like almost like a holy artifact. They weren't changing it substantially at all. But the video that the killer made of his attack, they were changing that a lot. They almost immediately started memeing the video. So they would add soundtracks, they would turn it into a video game, they would take clips out and add different clips, they would add subtitles, you know, add artwork into the video, I mean, just all kinds of changes.
Megan says the more variations, the harder it is to remove something from the internet. So while there was some success in getting rid of the manifesto, the video was another story.
For somebody like the New Zealand government, I mean, they want the videos removed. They feel like it glorifies this tragic event. For people who study extremism, like myself, we notice radicalization that happens after one incident. You know, other incidents could happen.
Another deadly shooting in a house of worship. It happened in a synagogue in Poway, California.
6 weeks after the New Zealand attack, a 19-year-old man opened fire at a synagogue in Southern California, killing one person and injuring three others. Before that attack, the gunman posted his own manifesto on Facebook.
And in that manifesto, he cited the New Zealand shooter. So one can lead to another. It's kind of like a domino effect.
So it's really hard to stop the spread of this type of extremism on the internet. What are the social media companies, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, what are they saying about it? Like, how are they trying to stop it?
Yeah, so they have a two-prong approach right now. One, they're putting bodies on it, so just more moderators, more eyes, you know, human eyes on the problem.
Facebook is purging several high-profile names from its platform.
Yesterday, Twitter announced that it is permanently suspending the accounts of the conservative commentator Alex Jones.
Alex Jones and his media outlet InfoWars.
Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan.
Paul Joseph Watson, who's a notorious anti-Muslim conspiracy theorist.
They're being banned for spreading, quote, dangerous ideology.
Social media companies call this deplatforming. Megan says executives are also talking up another approach to removing hate speech from the internet.
Which is like, well, pretty soon we'll be able to solve this with artificial intelligence, right? Like, we'll be able to throw machine learning or some kind of AI at this problem, and that'll take care of it. Mark Zuckerberg, for example, is on record in front of Congress saying that AI is going to solve it.
Over the long term, building AI tools is going to be the scalable way to identify and root out most of this harmful content. We're investing a lot in doing that, as well as scaling up the number of people who are doing content review.
It's a pretty hard line to toe, though. Like, it's just really hard. I don't know how many eyeballs we would have needed to stop something like the live streaming of the New Zealand shooter. I think there's maybe some other things I could do, you know, as a stopgap until their magical AI solution comes to fruition. But even that, I'm kind of a pessimist about. So,
The AI solution, I don't know. Like, how are you going to teach a computer to understand how hate and extremism works in America? Like, it's a very human, it's an emotional thing, isn't it? I just have a hard time, like, believing that AI is going to be able to figure that out.
It's extremely challenging. It's also kind of creepy. I mean, we've all seen Minority Report, right? Movies like that, where you try to predict people's behavior. So I think this is a really kind of dark road they're going down.
Megan says there's something else going on, something that makes it even harder for government regulators and mainstream technology companies. It's called alt tech.
I like to think of alt tech as, okay, so imagine you have a playground at school and there's a bully on your playground and the teacher keeps putting the bully in timeout. So the bully gets his dad to build a brand new playground with the same slides and the same, you know, teeter-totters and all that stuff. That's alt tech. They're getting put in timeout on the traditional playground of social media, right? And so now they're moving into their own special playground that they're getting people to build just for them. And they can do whatever they want in there. So alt tech is a suite. It's like really a replacement infrastructure for the internet as we know it. So it's everything from special browsers and plugins to browsers to payment processors and domain registration and web hosting and just all of VPN services, just all those things that make up the internet the way we use it. And they're just building a copycat version of that for themselves where they can say and do what they like.
One player in the alt tech movement who caught Megan's attention is a guy named Rob Monster.
Rob Monster is the CEO of Epic.com. He's the dad. He's the bully dad in my playground scenario. He is the domain registrar right now for Gab, which is a sort of alt tech social network. It's like a Twitter clone, kind of. He's also domain registrar for BitChute, which is like a YouTube alternative that shows videos that YouTube won't show, which is, you know, YouTube will show a lot of videos. So that tells you a little bit about BitChute. He also just does web hosting for tons of alt-right podcasts, things like that.
Today, I have a very exciting guest.
Rob wouldn't talk to us, but we have an interview of him on something called The People Square.
Oh, yeah. That's a alt-right podcast. It's run by a guy named Eric Stryker. He goes by that. That's not his real name.
How are you, Rob?
Hey, good. Good to be with you.
On the show, Monster attacks the radical left, the government, and big tech companies. But he says this about David Duke, the white nationalist and former KKK leader.
When he has some, you know, far-right views and so forth, but he's actually a pretty clever guy. He's, you know, articulate. He knows history. And I don't know the body of his work, but I have a feeling that many people grew up with this mindset that says, you know, you should never listen to anything that David Duke says. Or
he's really one of the central players in attempting to build this alt-tech infrastructure stack. It would be a replacement for the regular internet tools that we all use. He's really into the fact that he has a right to do it. So if we have a right to do something, he feels like he has to express that by physically helping to build the tools to engage that right. So the First Amendment, right? Free speech.
Our mandate is essentially to allow the public internet to function as intended. And that sometimes means developing appropriate technology countermeasures.
So he has taken it on himself to build these tools to help companies and organizations and websites and podcasts and stuff that are so extreme they've been kicked off of regular media, regular platforms, and he wants to provide them with an alternative.
It sounds like he's hearkening back to the early days of the internet.
You know, they're always remembering back to an earlier time, which may or may not have actually existed. But this is another case where he's, you know, hearkening back to the days when the internet was free. The internet may have felt more free to some people then, but it wasn't less filled with hate. It just was a little bit harder for that hate to spread. neo-Nazi groups and the Klan and all these kind of white nationalist groups, they've been on the internet since pretty much day one. They were very excited about this technology. They've been there. It just wasn't quite as easy for them to spread their message, and you had to look for it a little bit harder. So, yeah, they are building something that looks a lot like that.
Megan says she's especially troubled by one piece of Rob Monster's technology arsenal. It's known as the Interplanetary File System, or IPFS. It splits files into many pieces that are spread out among thousands of participants on a network.
On its own, it's just another technology like any other. But the way he weaponized this was to deliberately store the manifesto from the Christchurch shooter and the video out on there as a, almost as a thumbing his nose, right, at the idea that this material could be taken down by regular social media platforms. So he was, in a way, he was kind of fronting, like, oh, I'm building this alt tech stack, and part of that's going to be this decentralized technology, and you'll never be able to take down files that we put out there.
So where's all this going?
Yeah, that's one of the things that worries me the most. It's one of the things that keeps me up thinking about how this is going to play out in the future. So deplatforming barely works as it is with the social media companies the way they are. And this alt tech stack will probably continue to grow, and it'll get bigger. There will be a move towards the decentralized web, which is kind of this peer-to-peer internet replacement. And once that's in place, if that's in place, it will be very hard to appeal to any centralized authority to do things like remove manifesto files or take a person off, you know, a disruptive person off of a social media site.
Do you think that the problems that we're seeing now that are kind of rising to the surface, that some of that can be attributed to the fact that the United States government and governments around the world have been really slow to understand exactly what the problem is? And so if they don't understand how Facebook works, how can they regulate Facebook? If they don't understand how this alt-platforming alternative dimension works, how can they actually look out for the little guy if they don't understand how it works?
It bothers me to no end that they still don't understand how the internet works. There are governments, though, around the world that do understand how this stuff works and are already taking steps to just use their version of alt tech or the separate internet for censorship purposes, to remove their country from the main internet. So there was a story about Russia doing exactly that. You know, there's a well-documented history of Chinese censorship of dozens of pieces of the internet.
It's interesting that two big countries that are actually weaponizing the internet are the two countries that are ahead of the curve when it comes to thinking about how to handle this type of stuff. Also, I would say that those two countries really don't care about free speech at all. So do we, as the United States, have to become like that?
That's a completely legitimate worry. And I study hate speech every day. I study these just absolutely vile, dark, incredibly toxic places online. And yeah, it's not a happy place to be thinking about any kind of censorship. I mean, it's just bad. And yet here we are. People are dying. So I'm absolutely nauseated with the idea that Russia and China censor, and should the United States be in that position? It's just, it's awful.
What is it like for you to have to go into these dark corners of the internet every day?
I try to send my software there first. So, mostly I study. I try to write programs that can take some of the load, organize stuff, put it where it needs to be so I can study it, try to be very systematic about it, try to keep an eye on the prize, you know. It can be very tiring, though, especially when I start thinking about the stuff in the future. When I read that comment Rob Monster posted on Gab about, he was bragging about how he had stored copies of that manifesto onto a decentralized web platform so that it could never be censored or removed. And he was really proud of that. And I just felt so tired. So I could see how this was all going to play out in the future. It's going to be vigilante hacker groups, you know, battling it out, and who can invent the next technology that'll be able to store things even more safely, more securely. Oh my gosh. Okay, here we go. So,
Megan, you have scared the hell out of me.
I'm sorry. The alt-right guys call that a black pill, by the way. They call it when you give someone so much depressing information that they're saddened about it. So I'm sorry. I didn't mean to blackpill you.
No, we should just, well, don't worry. I mean, we should name this podcast Black Pill because we do it every week.
Yeah, there you go.
So Megan Squire, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
It was my pleasure.
Black pills, vigilante hackers, fighting a cyber war to spread hate. Sounds like something straight out of a comic book. And it's a story that's already being written.
I like the Marilyn Monroe-shaped redhead. Who's she?
Oh, that's Dina Meek. She's the newest recruit to the Global Justice Initiative.
From alt tech to alt comics, coming up on Reveal.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. We're tracing the rise of hate today. Far right spreads their message in a lot of different ways. And last year, they got into a sacred space for me, comic books. As a kid, comics gave me heroes and heartbreak. They also helped me overcome dyslexia and fall in love with reading, artwork, and stories. I am and always will be a comic book nerd. Which is why my spidey sense started tingling when I heard last year about a new independent comic book, a new recruiting tool trying to broaden the appeal of the so-called alt-right. It's called Alt Hero.
He could just be another vigilante.
This is a promotional video for Alt Hero. There's some comic book art of a little white girl cowering in an alley. A large brown-skinned man with a mustache menaces her. Then a white vigilante appears out of nowhere and knocks the brown-skinned guy out and drops him off at immigration.
Cleaning up the streets, one illegal at a time.
6 issues of Alt Hero have been published since the first came out last year. Hate comics are now a part of our culture wars. And one of the soldiers in that war is a man who has a name like a supervillain, Vox Day.
It's a big step in the culture wars because it's the first time that the right is actually taking back ground that the left had previously claimed.
Vox Day is the creator of Alt Hero.
Anything the left tells us is off limits. We're going to be going for that, and we're going to go for it hard.
The characters in his comics have secret identities. So does he, sort of. His birth name is
Theodore Beale, and he's from Minnesota.
That's Amanda Robb. She's a reporter with the nonprofit newsroom Type Investigations. I talked with Amanda last year when she was writing a story on alt-right comics and Vox Day.
And even though he's an American white nationalist, he lives in Europe, and he is what you would call an influencer or even a thought leader of the alt-right.
What else do you know about Vox Day besides that he's writing and publishing Alt Hero?
He runs an independent publishing house that puts out books by other extreme conservatives. He's a prolific blogger. He wrote an influential manifesto on the alt-right. By his early 30s, he was calling himself Vox Day, which means the voice of God, roughly. But sometimes he also calls himself the Supreme Dark Lord.
So he calls himself the Supreme Dark Lord. And then he wonders why people make him out to be evil.
Yeah, it's hard to understand.
Okay, so when did the Alt Hero comic book get started?
Well, Vox launched a crowdfunding campaign after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. That was in August 2017, and he started crowdfunding in September.
In May of 2018, Vox Day went on InfoWars to talk about getting into comics. That's the far-right website and radio show that's so extreme, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube banned it. He talked to InfoWars host Alex Jones.
I realize that this is information warfare, and comics are paramount right now because they're archetypal, and it's something the enemy completely controls. I like the Marilyn Monroe-shaped redhead. Who's she?
That's Dina Meek, and she's the newest recruit to the Global Justice Initiative.
He's talking about the cover of the first issue of Vault Hero.
Well, I got to tell you, it's awesome because notice she doesn't look like a heroin head. She hasn't been drinking soy. She looks like a woman.
Yeah, it's actually a lot of fun to go in and violate pretty much all of the SJW imperatives.
SJW. That's short for Social Justice Warriors. Right-wing activists like Vox Day use it as a diss against people who don't agree with them.
You know, if you look at what they're doing, they keep introducing more and more gay characters, more and more transgender characters, and this is very, very intentional.
Vox Day is trying to make the argument that Social Justice Warriors are on a mission to ruin comics with a leftist, feminist, diversity agenda. The marketing of Vault Hero is all about stoking those fears. That's one of the things Amanda wanted to talk to Vox Day about.
So I got in touch with him, and at first he said no. He doesn't, you know, talk to the mainstream media because we're all fake news and we lie. But then he rethought. He finally agreed to meet me. So I said, great, you know, where are you? And he was like, I'm not telling you. I'm like, all right, well, come to your office in Finland. He's like, no, you can't come there. So I'm like, okay, so where can we meet? And he picked the Geneva airport.
Geneva, Switzerland?
Yeah, I was in Europe for a different story, so I went to meet him.
What happened?
I went to a restaurant in the airport, and I look around, and there's a white guy in a gray T-shirt, and he has thinning hair. Just a regular-looking white guy like I went to high school with. And then we ordered, like, the world's most expensive hamburgers. And I want to say we talked for 3 hours, but really I listened to him for 3 hours.
Vox's first law, mm-hmm. Any sufficiently advanced intelligence is indistinguishable from insanity.
And what's that a play on?
Arthur C. Clarke's first law of science and magic.
Which is?
Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Okay. And what does it mean? He was the hardest interview I've ever done and the worst interview I've ever done. It was Austrian philosophers and war theory and, you know, genetic information, and it was all tangled and knotted.
Do you, like, not think women should vote?
I think it depends. In a representative democracy, no.
Me? I'm so smart.
I've lived for years in a place where I couldn't vote. So I don't quite understand what the issue is.
Not because of your gender, because you're not a citizen.
Yeah. But I mean, the main...
So after you met him that one time and had expensive hamburgers, did you talk to him again?
Yeah, we've talked on the phone, we've talked by Skype. He was actually very, you know, nice to me and forthcoming in his own very intellectual, convoluted way until he got mad at me.
Why'd he get mad at you? Because you wanted to vote, or... So, who's distributing Alt Hero?
Amazon.
Why is Amazon distributing this book?
Well, I asked Amazon, and someone from their PR department got back to me. He said it falls within their guidelines. He helpfully sent me a link to their guidelines, so I clicked on them, and it says their definition of offensive material is, and I'm quoting, what we deem offensive is probably about what you would expect, end quote.
That doesn't make sense because I find this offensive, and they don't find it offensive.
Well, it's a very movable goalpost, it turns out. Amazon changes what it thinks is offensive all the time.
So talk to me about Alt Hero.
This is from a Skype call that Amanda and Vox had before he ghosted us.
Well, a lot of people came up, had been telling me that they wanted me to get into comics.
Okay.
He says he just felt there was a crying need for this, that the superhero universe had become diverse for diversity's sake. They weren't heroic anymore.
They're female Thor, they're, you know, fat Samoan G.I. Joe soldier.
But he thought, okay, you know, I'll give it a whirl and see if there's an audience out for that.
What happened was a guy named Chuck Dixon backed the project.
Chuck Dixon. Chuck Dixon is one of my all-time favorite comic book writers.
All these people got excited. because they're like, oh, Chuck Dixon is backing it.
Uh-huh.
I called him up to thank him for backing it, and he said, yeah, no problem. He's happy to do so. And then I said, well, you know, I hear that you're not writing much for Marvel or DC anymore. Do you want to work with us? And he said, sure. So I actually turned over an entire line to him. Basically, he's creating our Gotham.
Chuck and I have something in common. I also write comic books. And a couple years ago, I published my first story with DC Comics. I got to write Nightwing, Batman's former sidekick. He's a character Chuck wrote all those years ago. Now, in my opinion, Chuck didn't just write Nightwing, he defined him. And now, this legend in the comics community is writing in the alt-hero universe. And Chuck is not alone. So obviously, Alt Hero is an independent project on the fringes. Is there anything else out there like it?
Oh, yeah. It's a burgeoning genre. Alt Hero is just one of a handful of crowdfunded far-right comic books that have cropped up recently.
Wow. Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you, Al.
That was Amanda Robb, reporter with Type Investigations. I was so surprised and disappointed that Chuck had agreed to write comics for a white supremacist that I decided I had to hear from him why he decided to do it. So I flew to Florida to meet Chuck.
We were at Yancey Street Comics in Port Richey, Florida. And this is just an awesome shop, as you can see.
Yancey Street Comics is an old school comic shop in a strip mall. It looks exactly like the image that pops up in your head. Spacious with rows and rows and rows of comic books and toys. I fell in love with this place the minute I walked in.
How long have you been writing comics?
Over 30 years.
Chuck has metal frame glasses, and these days his goatee is a little more white than gray. Back in the day, Chuck wrote a bunch of comic classics that I grew up on. The Fantastic Four, The Punisher, Batman. Chuck also wrote for a lesser-known comic book startup called CrossGen.
I remember CrossGen. I had several of their titles. They had the sigil, right? They had
the
yin and yang sigil.
Yeah.
And to be quite honest, like I probably started buying CrossGen because your name was on it. If your name is on the book, I'm going to pick it up.
Well, I appreciate that.
He tells me that over the years, his personal politics haven't always lined up with what he's assigned to write in the comics.
I've written impassioned anti-gun speeches for Batman. I mean, I've laid out in reasonable, passionate terms why Batman doesn't like guns and why they're bad. You know, and I don't believe anything of what I put in his mouth, but I wrote it.
Chuck's a supporter of gun rights. He's described himself as a Genghis Khan far-right conservative. He says he hasn't worked for Marvel Comics since 2002. That's when Marvel brought back an Old West cowboy character named Rawhide Kid.
The Rawhide Kid. And they brought the Rawhide Kid back as gay. I said a few things online, like, why don't you create a new character who's gay? They wrote Rawhide Kid as a sissy, and that was the joke of the series. And I'm like, how is this a pro-gay comic book? How are you presenting this guy as a gay hero in any kind of serious attempt, you know, at what you think you're trying to do?
If you're a gay kid and you like comic books and you've never seen yourself represented in comics, I don't know. I just feel like, shouldn't they be able to come into a comic shop and see themselves?
I don't have a problem with it as long as you create a new character.
Right, but creating, you and I both know, like, how hard it is to, like, launch a new character.
See, that's the problem. That's where the agenda, putting the agenda, you know, and I'm not saying you have an agenda. There's nothing wrong with you wanting to see a character that you can relate to more closely. But when you put the agenda before the story, that's where the problem lies. Because then you come up with uninteresting characters for the sake of diversity.
Then I asked the question that brought me all the way down to Florida. Why work with Vox Day?
Well, he approached me. I didn't know much about him. I still don't know a whole lot about him. But, I mean, this is the first time in my experience that I've gone to work on a job and everybody's concerned with who's publishing it and their background and their beliefs and everything else. Because this guy is like, man, is this guy a lightning rod? And I don't agree with a whole lot of what he says, but he was offering me an opportunity to do creator-owned work And he had a funding thing, and he had a distribution deal set up, and he admitted that he didn't know what he didn't know, you know, so he wasn't telling me what to do. He was asking me what I should do or what would be best for me and all the rest of it. Offered me an opportunity and didn't tell me what to write and still has not told me what to write. So to me, it was just an opportunity to be free of the kind of constraints that are put on you at the major companies. The political correctness constraints. I wasn't interested in doing a book that was political. I wasn't interested in doing a message book.
So he's not asking you to write anything political, but you understand how, like, just working with him is political.
You know, I've read the alt hero thing, and I've rejected parts of it I didn't want to do, you know, that I don't agree with, and I don't write to that.
I understand that, like, you know, it's an opportunity to write and to do all of this other stuff. But what it means for me is that you are lending him your credibility.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how much credibility I lend him. Seriously.
Earlier, I told you that I started reading CrossGen.
Right.
Because your name was on it. But the only reason why I went with them is because you, in essence, gave it its credibility for me. And to other people who may not know what Vox Day is about, who may be just on the outside of all of this, they see a comic book in the store and it's got Chuck Dixon's name on it, and they pick it up.
Right.
And then they see, like, oh, this is in that universe. And then they pick up Vox Day stuff. Like, you are giving him credibility.
Yeah, I don't even know how to deal with that.
Yeah.
Because I don't believe that I lend that much credibility to anybody.
Certainly,
the majority of the people in this industry who do hiring, the gatekeepers, don't see me.
Yeah, but those are different people.
I mean, all my work is for outsiders. Right. I'm doing a lot of work for guys that I'd never heard of 6 months ago, and now I'm working for them.
Can you understand, like, how you writing for them feels like to the people that grew up reading your books, who are Black, who are Jewish, who, you know.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I can see your point of view on it. And I don't really have a ready answer for you. I don't have a pat answer for you. It's, you know, I'm doing my work from my point of view, and it doesn't really share everything.
A few weeks after I talked to Chuck in Florida, his series for Vox Day launched. Vox bragged about it on InfoWars.
We've got the best writer in comics who's doing a separate series for us called Avalon. His name's Chuck Dixon. He's the man, and it's only going to get better from here.
That was last year. 2 months ago, Chuck started another comic series for Vox Day. It's called Alt Hero Q, a reference to QAnon. That's the totally bogus far-right conspiracy theory that there are people within the government dubbed the deep state who are out to undermine President Trump. Chuck also published a new comic on his own called Trump's Space Force, where Trump is a superhero fighting aliens in something called the MAGAverse. As we've seen hate spread, how are communities of color responding? That story next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. And this is episode one of a two-part series on hate in America. We've talked a lot about how white supremacists are weaponizing everyday things like the internet or comic books. But that hate doesn't just stay in those places. They're just petri dishes where the contagion grows. We've seen the results of it. Churches burned to ash in Louisiana. A gunman kills 11 in a Pittsburgh synagogue. The Mother Emanuel Church massacre in South Carolina, just to name a few. But what about the communities that are targeted? The people. It's an issue that Pastor Michael McBride has been dealing with his whole life. He's known nationally for his work to end gun violence and mass incarceration, and he says the contagion of hate is spreading further and becoming more dangerous.
Well, I think we're seeing a rise in violence among many vulnerable populations. You know, I think it's critical for us to appreciate that the kind of rise of authoritarianism, totalitarianism, is happening literally all across the globe. Yeah, we see this happening both here and abroad, and it's quite frightening.
Does that mean that, like, now you have to organize basically on two fronts, i.e., one front being thinking about systemic racism, as well as now you have to worry about the rise of white nationalism in just everyday people?
For some of us, we don't see those as very separate, right? You know, it's worth noting that many, if not a good chunk of the individuals who were participating in these kind of white nationalist rallies, they work on somebody's job. We know these folks are judges. We know these folks are teachers. We know these folks work in stores. So they're around us all of the time. Now, of course, the public expression of that pre-Charlottesville or pre the inauguration of Donald Trump, this is a new reality, right? And so it's not to diminish this idea that, yes, we have to organize ourselves against the legacy of systemic and structural oppression and violence at the hands of the state that is often, if not always, racialized and otherized. And now we have to organize ourselves against the very real and imminent threats of both visible and invisible forms of white supremacy and white nationalism that is around us all of the time. We have still places and spaces that are known to be Ku Klux Klan, you know, meeting spaces, right? And so this stuff is around us, but it's just much more ubiquitous.
Charlottesville still surprised me.
Mm.
Like, I was still caught off guard by it. Not that I thought that it wasn't there,
mm-hmm.
more that I thought that we are past the time when people outwardly show this type of stuff. Were you surprised by it?
My first reaction, I actually fell into despair. I was a little bit, you know, in tears because they surrounded a church filled with Christian people and some other interfaith partners. And I was saying to myself, man, I should be there with you guys. And so they came to a church in the South and surrounded it with torches. And it was terrifying, right? So the second was just sorrow, you know, sorrow that this was under our nose and we either were not in touch enough to be able to expect it. I was definitely surprised by their chance. Like, this idea that Jews would not replace us. And these people have created their own kind of orchestrated, like rehearsed kind of public demonstration of hatred and annihilation. And they feel comfortable to do it in the public. I think that was quite sorrowful and a bit surprising, but that quickly dissipated as I began to just think of the buildup, right? I mean, again, our experience of state violence happened in Ferguson. In Ferguson, we had white clergy and some white police officers calling us the N-word, sticking us in the back with guns. They were doing that on camera. Now, nobody responded, but that still happened. It happened to me personally. Trump, he runs, and he is publicly kind of whipping this into a frenzy. No one was really, like, trying to reel that in. And so as I began to think about just the progression of this, which is why it's so dangerous for many of us, I think, in this moment to not take this as seriously as it should, because these things are all seeming to be progressions. We have to take seriously that if we don't organize people away from racism and hatred, they will be seduced by it and arguably become agents of that.
Communities of color have a long history of fighting back against white supremacy,
mm-hmm.
mostly, not all, but mostly through nonviolent means. Has the model changed? Has the game shifted so much that maybe nonviolent protest isn't the only way forward?
Well, you know, I think we should not conflate nonviolence with self-defense. Right. And if you were living in the South where Ku Klux Klan and white terrorists were bombing churches and lynching people, you know, with the cover of the state, right, trying to defend yourself with necessary force would still probably get you a death sentence. I think, you know, as someone who you know, of course, is living in this space, I think we should just continue to not conflate the two and yet still remember that we do not want to become the monsters that we are attempting to defeat.
A little pushback on that. So I did a documentary on Bayard Rustin. And I should just say for our listeners who are not familiar with Bayard Rustin, Bayard Rustin was the man who basically taught Martin Luther King the practice of nonviolence. He was a gay man who had been fighting against racism. But the scene of him meeting Martin Luther King for the first time is that he goes into Martin Luther King's house. There are men surrounding King with rifles. And Bayard's thing to him was, off the bat, you've got to get rid of all the guns. You cannot have any guns, because if you have guns and people do heinous things to you, you're going to use those guns and you're going to undermine our position. So what you're saying is the way that you see nonviolence is that, like, when you're going out and you're protesting, you're absolutely, like, nonviolent. Like, you're not going there with violent intent, but you're prepared to defend yourself and your community if put in that position.
I believe that no act of self-defense should be off the table. It should be up to individuals to decide how they are willing to preserve their life or the lives of those that they love. I think too often we only want nonviolence for Black folk, and violence can be then for everyone else. I would like police officers to be nonviolent. I would like the government to be nonviolent when it attempts to go resolve conflicts all across the world. I would like teachers to be nonviolent when they deal with unruly kids in the schools. But it seems to me that violence is okay for everyone except for Black people. And that is an immoral position that we should not, I think, allow the systems that are, as Dr. King says, the greatest exploiters of violence in the world is our government, to lecture or give advice to people, oppressed people, about how they choose to either reach for liberation or defend themselves. I personally am a student of Dr. King, a follower of Jesus. I commit myself to nonviolent from a moral, spiritual place and a strategic place, because we do not have enough guns to defeat the United States government.
How do you think police departments have handled this new outward emergence of white supremacy?
Well, I think it depends. Like, one thing the work has taught us is it's very difficult to have integrity and be too generalizing. I think some of the police departments have taken very seriously this idea that they have to lean into issues related to race, bias, and the ways in which that shows up in policing. Now, it's an extremely low bar. Let's start there, right? If you are willing to do an implicit bias or procedural justice training in your department, we know that that is not going to transform your department, but it is a first of many steps. There have been a few police departments willing to do that. There have been many police departments that have not been willing to even do that one step. And so I argue that if police departments don't take seriously the presence of white nationalism, anti-Blackness, anti-immigrant, if you don't take seriously these kinds of influences that are just in the air we breathe and the water we drink, then you as a department are failing to provide adequate public safety in the 21st century, given all the many threats that are imminent and invisible and even visible.
I think the issue, though, is that, just like you said, it's in the air we breathe. And I think that most people, because it's in the air, they have no idea it's there. Like, it's just a part of them. It's a part of the way we, it's a part of, like, actually, I should say, it's a part of all of us. Like,
yes,
we all are in that system.
But this is where police officers and the profession have to reimagine themselves in this moment in time. Police departments, I believe, have to remind themselves that they work for the people. The people do not work for them. They are public servants. They have one of the most powerful positions in this country, in that they can take a person's life without any accountability, right? And so the idea that police officers don't have power, don't have to be better stewards of their power, is irresponsible to both the profession and to the officer. We are asking, do your due diligence, do whatever it takes to attend to your biases that are both historical in your profession and personal in your formation. Number two, submit yourself to the accountability of the people you serve.
How probable do you think that is?
It's as probable as the people make it. I mean, the power belongs to the people in a democracy. Now, of course, you know, there have always been moments where everything seemed impossible. You know, we were in the fields picking cotton. It was impossible. When Jim Crow happened, it was impossible. You know, it's impossible until it's not.
What gives you hope?
What gives me hope? Well, young people give me hope. I'm 43. I'd like to think I'm still a little bit young, but I'm not as young as I used to be. I think young people give me hope because they continue to push for a world that we have not been able to yet realize. My faith gives me hope, and organizing gives me hope because it allows me to see that every day there are people outside the view of the media that are changing this country. And they are waking up every day, attempting to get people across difference to come into rooms and spaces and imagine that we belong to one another. There are folks who are registering folks to vote even right now, formerly incarcerated people winning new policies to make sure folks can vote and make sure folks can have equal protection under the law and access to jobs and housing. All of that action gives me hope, and I'm excited for the opportunity to bring that hope into the public square.
That's Pastor Michael McBride. In addition to founding the Way Church in Berkeley, California, he also leads a national campaign to end gun violence and mass incarceration. Finally today, I have a confession. Let me explain. I am a theater guy. I write plays. I act. I go to the theater as often as I can. In some ways, theater is my church. Okay, so here's my confession. I just saw Hamilton for the first time. I know, I just never got around to it. Tickets were insane, and well, it never really happened until recently. But I listen to the music all the time. This song is my jam. And I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. Lin-Manuel Miranda is brilliant. He took history and made it come alive. The performers killed it, the music was infectious, and everyone had a good time, including me. Until I started thinking about it the next day. And something wasn't right. I could feel it in my chest and unsettling. And then it hit me. I was in a theater, and the audience was mostly white, and the performers were mostly people of color, and the historical figures they were playing were mostly white men, many of whom owned slaves. And slavery was barely mentioned in the play. You see, I could see me in the actors, and that was great, but I couldn't see me in the story, the history. And that gets to the root of the issue. America, the place, the ideas, the freedom that Hamilton was fighting for was exclusively for white men. The foundation of the United States of America is white supremacy. And there's a clear line from stealing land from the indigenous people to start this country, to the Civil War, Reconstruction, the Civil Rights Movement, Charlottesville, to right now. It's all connected. Over the last couple of years, a lot of people's eyes have been opened to the threat of white supremacists when there are these violent outbursts. And I get that, but there's other forms of racism that are more subtle and baked into American institutions. And that's what we're going to look at next week on Reveal. How racism and discrimination are affecting everything from policing to banking to Hollywood. Before we go, I want to tell you about something new coming this summer to public television, Reveal TV. Over the course of four shows, we'll bring you the work from award-winning filmmakers. One episode I really liked is a story of a controversial counterterrorism expert. Some people say she sees terrorist threats where none exist.
The bad guys today can be jihadists, Al-Qaeda,
ISIS?
We are coming and we will destroy you.
White supremacists.
America was built by and for the white Christian people of this nation.
It's identifying cells, is going to the source. It's understanding where the threat is coming from. How do they do what they do?
To find out where you can watch the show, call your local public television station or check our website, revealnews.org/revealTV. This week's show was produced by Najeeb Amini, Will Carlos, Emily Harris, Michael Montgomery, and Michael Schiller, with help from Caitlin Benz. The show was edited by our executive producer, Kevin Sullivan, with help from Taki Talanidis. Our production manager is Mwende Inahosa, score and sound design by the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Matt Thompson is our editor-in-chief. Our theme music is by Camerado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.
From PRX.